wins is it? Okay.
Okay, this is the recording for the Participatory Narrative Inquiry Institute for February 13th, 2019. I almost said 18. And our topic today is PNI and learning, that is instruction, training, but also just sort of knowledge, know-how, whatever. So let's have a quick round where we say who we are. I'm Cynthia Kurtz, and I'm a researcher and consultant in this area.
Hello, I'm Stephen Sillett, and I used PNI as part of my evaluation and project development work, and I work with communities around local issues and using drama and other approaches.
I'm Murray McGregor, and I am a performance storyteller, and my interest in PNI is part of my interest in the use of narrative within our wider culture.
And my name is Rolf Gardner from the Netherlands. We use PNI a lot in the mixed mode, a lot of digital story collection, and a lot of offline sense-making sessions for a variety of subjects and customers, commercial and non-commercial.
Okay, so just to notice, I'm going to be coughing. So Stephen had brought up an interesting point or something about this topic. So why don't you tell us again, Stephen, what you said?
Yeah. Okay. Well, the thing that I've been wrestling with is the idea of how PNI relates to working with communities and projects, and how that engagement relates to stories going up to organizational levels and beyond to support decision making, and also how it might relate to engagements that sort of stay within that local community level, be it, and areas that have come up for me in terms of questioning on that, looking at some work in other organizations and doing research for my PhD, is co-design, the area of co-design with people, where people might be on a more iterative process there, maybe a little bit more opinion orientated process. So can that also continue, be it as a maybe that should be where certain things go for certain parts of the project. The relationship to learning in a developmental evaluation form. So, you know, how much should the PNI process be used in terms of people coming together, looking at the stories and, you know, helping to inform those decisions at a higher level, maybe sorting through stories, or how much should just the stories be fed into people as a who are facilitating, just as source material, in a bit like more like standard narrative inquiry work. So that's the kind of question that's been coming up for me. And there's a few areas where stuff is now, there's some areas around co-design, as I mentioned, asset-based development work, which talks about, first of all, finding out what the community would like, is able to do, wants to do, and only after that ask for help from outside. And so those initial stages, which may not be about the community giving feedback around a program that's been brought in, but it may be the community being up and running amongst themselves. So that's the kind of question that I'm debating, is how much do I push through PNI in terms of all the different types of dialogue and thinking, and how much should either be integrated with something within that local level, and how much should be about really building something that you can connect to an action learning team, or something that it can get to advocacy or learning at the organizational level. Because there is a qualitative difference to being at the organizational level, because you're within a particular orientated field of practice. And community members are in a more non-linear space. So, and part of P&I that I think is really interesting is that you help people to understand what the purpose is of asking for their stories, so that they make sense in relation to that orientation. So if you're trying to understand how to make your project more efficient and effective versus make it more aesthetically pleasing versus XYZ, that is actually built into the question. So it means that it's built in, because at the organizational level, you need to know what the orientation is and what the kind of purpose is. But that may not be so relevant within a community context where things are much more sort of fuzzy, if that makes sense. So that's some of the stuff that I'm thinking about there. Any thoughts?
I have some thoughts. They're not very well organized, but if you think about learning and the things people need to learn, I feel like stories make sense when, like, you talk about, you know, you collect stories and then you disseminate them so to help people learn something. And that's kind of, that can be a bottom-up approach. It can also be done top-down, where instead of collecting stories, you just make them up. And you just, you know, they're kind of designed instead of gathered. And I think what you're saying is that there is a context in which it's not really appropriate to do that. There's top-down and there's bottom-up, but then there's, I don't know what you'd call it, but there's a value in stories that basically stay at the bottom, where there's story work that enhances learning, but it doesn't travel outside of a local context. It's about the people in the local context learning together, and it isn't something that goes everywhere and it doesn't get disseminated. It's just helping people to be empowered. And it actually reminds me of this paper that I worked on a long time ago about, and it had a thing about silos, and it was about how everybody says, oh, silos are terrible, you should always break down silos. And so I was curious about this, so I went and I looked up real silos, because I thought, well, if you're using the metaphor, maybe we should explore that. And it turns out that actually real silos, there's a lot of value to this keeping of things separate at the right time, and that a lot of the information about silos, the way they're designed, there's a lot of attention paid to the inflow and outflow. So, you know, it's like, how do you get the grain out of the silo? Well, how do you manage the flow? And how do you manage the flow into it? And how do you make sure that it's flowing the way it should, and it's not sticking, it's not, you know, a problem? And so instead of saying silos are terrible and everything has to be disseminated everywhere, it's better to talk about when is the right time for things to flow and how can they flow and when should they not flow and when should things stay local. And I think that's kind of what you're talking about when you're talking about co-design. It's like, when should you just, instead of saying, well, we're going to harvest learning from you and disseminate it to everywhere, when is it better to just say, we're going to make you more effective, and let's not worry about the whole dissemination thing. That doesn't matter right now. Is that kind of what you're saying?
It's kind of, I mean, I suppose there's two ways you can look at silos as well. I think there's the vertical dimension. If we take the vertical dimension to be sort of more grounded to the sort of action, and then beyond that to the kind of thinking kind of strategies of policymakers. Mm-hmm. So within there, there's a difference between, I think, at the local level, the way I've been really looking is it's the dynamics is much more of a non-linear, self-organizing.
Oh yes, yeah. Yes, and then the higher you go, the more organization gets introduced, more hierarchy.
And there's actually a recapitulation I'm seeing at the organization level, because one of the things that happens is you place, say we take a social topography, this idea of the landscape that people are in. Okay, so you've got people in that landscape at the local level, mm-hmm. not that in the work level. But at the work level, there's also a subconscious sort of orientation to the silo, okay, there. Mm-hmm. So there's, I think often silos are more thought of as differentiating things horizontally at the meso-organizational level. So there's that sense of how something goes from a very distributed context project level into one or more silos of activity focus. You know, it could be the accounts department, it could be the, you know, whatever it is. And so, and then there's also a kind of a silo in, but I don't know if I would use the word silo, because I think the at the very community level, things don't get siloed in a way, because they're more, how would I call it? It's a bit like pieces of land that get isolated. You see what I mean? I've got a big farmland, and I've got some land that's kind of tucked away behind the fence over there. But whatever happens, all the grain comes together, and this grain goes into that silo, and that grain goes into this silo. But that's once it's come together into that organized space. So I think this difference between the differentiation horizontally at the organization level and the different ways that things are engaged by people at the local level. It's just inherently, and that local level could be sort of the lived environment, even at a workplace, but it's still, I suppose it's living on social rules more than.
Well, the problem is that I think you can use the word local to mean either physically local, you know, like a community, or it can be local within a function. So like, what did you say? Accounting or something.
Yeah.
That's a locality too.
Yeah.
So well, it's hard to know what you mean by local.
Well, say for instance, you're in a big design agency. So I was working in an agency, and you go to the accounts department, and you go to the creative, and then you go to the kind of management department. Mm-hmm. Go to the same canteen, right? And they're all there, and it's kind of dispersed. But within the work, once they get into their workspace within their domain or their silo, they're orientated. They have a different value set around what they're going to focus on. And that's the piece that I'm finding really interesting at the organizational level. And I sense that the question that gets asked in P&I around what would you give the title to the story is also asked alongside the intention of gathering the story. And I think that helps that sense-making at that local level connect, without having to know the full field of practice and everything, to the intention of how it's going to be applied at the organizational level. Because it's somehow, you know, how high up the chain it goes, I don't know, but that idea of making it aligned to the strategic intent is more, it sits more easily in organizational work than it does in community work, because who decides what the orientation is? I don't know if it makes sense, but you don't necessarily have a particular sense-making question that you're trying to bridge the gap around. It tends to be maybe a more thematic exploration, which, and much more just like, what can we do in the context of this place? Mm-hmm.
But doesn't this whole learning thing usually depend on what kind of organization it is? I mean, I once read a document by McKinsey that was talking about left-handed and right-handed organizations.
And I forgot which one was which one, but one was services oriented, where everything was built around the customer. And the example was, lo and behold, IBM. I don't believe them, but that's what I wrote about. And the other was a car manufacturer that had one director and was totally, say, hierarchical with some directors on the top. But there I started thinking, well, wait a minute. If you go to Germany and you go to one of these large family-owned, what they call middle-sized companies with 10,000 people, there the board and the family are the researchers. And the whole organization is aligned and very ordered, and they follow. It's just like an army almost. And the research department is not in the bottom, it's in the top. The family decides where they take the family, which is probably something you also find in the US with family-led organizations, where the family members probably are simply touring the globe and deciding where the next market is. So, and of course, since then, and also in the 1930s, you had these both these networked operations where people following rules, started new outlets wherever they were. And today's example, of course, is Al-Qaeda. So I wonder, what is the learning process of Al-Qaeda? What is the learning process of a German top-down-led company and a real top-down-led company, and the other one, a bottom-up company, that services-oriented company or organization? And which of those resembles most learning in a village? I mean, I once was in a tippy tent in a wiki wherever, somewhere above of Toronto, Wiki Menon or whatever. And when you heard about how these First Nations solved problems in the village, I thought that's what we should do in every organization. So I'm not sure if you can. Now, let me put it positively. I wonder how many learning / P&I combinations how many P&I learning architectures you would need for these different type of organizational typologies.
Well, maybe I should give an example to kind of show what I'm thinking about for learning. Is one of the first projects I did on P&I when we were first developing it was in IBM, there's this patent process. Well, it's everywhere, but you know, and they really wanted to make sure that all their researchers knew how to do it, how to go through the process and knew all the details. And it's very complicated. excuse me. And so we got a whole lot of, what did they call them? Well, I can't remember what they called them, but these people who had gotten a lot of patents to their, you know, their names on a lot of patents. And we had a whole bunch of them in the room, a couple of rooms. And we had them talk about their experiences. You know, when were you surprised? What's a time you remember? What was a high point? What was a low point? That kind of thing. And we gathered all these stories, and then the group I was working with was writing a help system for doing the patent system. So it was like, here's how to do the process. And there were all these steps and, you know, it was like a frequently asked questions and everything. And every one of the factual things was connected to a story that we had collected. And so they'd say, you know, here's how to do this. Would you like to read a story about this? And so the stories and the instructional material were kind of in these parallel streams. And what they found when they watched people do it was that the people would read the instructional thing. They'd say, what's this, a story? And then they'd go look at the story. And then when you looked at one story, you could see a lot of related stories. And then they'd just kind of go and hang out in the stories for a while. And they, because they were interesting. And so they'd find out all these other things that they hadn't really been looking for, but it was interesting to them. And they'd get all this other understanding. And then they'd come back to the factual stuff. And so it was a really interesting complement to the instructional stuff. And so that was an example of what I'm saying, this kind of bottom-up thing where, you know, you go out to the population and you find the people who have experience with it, and you sort of mine their experience and you make that available to people all over. But I think what I was picking up on what you were saying, Stephen, is there are times when you really shouldn't do that dissemination. You shouldn't incorporate it into a wide resource, but more like focus on there's a particular group and you need to help them develop their ability to transmit their knowledge even just within that group. Just give them better practices so that it happens naturally, that it's not sort of codified. It's just more of a living practice that they do. And I think those both ways of doing it are complementary. On the one hand, it's kind of crystallizing it in these resources. And on the other hand, it's kind of like the verb versus the noun, you know, which one do you put more emphasis on?
Cynthia, that if a group, when you help them start sharing stories and you observe that they are making sense of it together and they share stories amongst, so return is organized, then you're done. You can leave.
Well, yeah.
You've been successful. I mean, the P&I circle is closed. And we call that a story circle. Story circles are everywhere. They are shared. They're gained insight. People make decisions or change their ways so that new stories are shared. And that cycle goes on and on and on. And in P&I, it has three steps. And we put in the intervention thing that somebody learned, somebody we put it in the main circle. But it's the same thing. I mean, if that runs naturally in an organization, they're doing P&I.
Well, the thing
they
is,
just don't need.
When that circle happens, it usually happens locally. That is within one group.
Yeah.
And sometimes in an organization or a community, you need it to disseminate. You do need it to take root in other places. You can go separately to each thing, but there's also a lot of merit to doing this crystallization so that you can sort of seed, you know, new
stuff
in other places. So, you know, it's kind of like that's what seeds are. They're taking life and then, you know, encapsulating it and carrying it somewhere else and starting it again. And so there's a lot of merit to that too.
Well, that happened to me when I was traveling for OSAVE to all these organizations. And after 30 visits, I found myself only sharing stories from the other locations in the new location and taking, at some time I was the story database. I entered into the story database and I traveled on planes from one side to the other. that was off.
But that's a really good point, because you've got this sense of like, okay, you get something at one location and you could bring it to other locations, maybe at what you might say a similar systemic level, so there might be the idea of how this story informs how I take it to somewhere else. But I suppose in terms of there's a question then, so for instance, say I'm at the local level, I've got one option to say, okay, I work with this group. I'm thinking about this group that we're doing the project with disabilities that we're working on. Stories can help inform how we improve the project that you guys are in. So it's like you're helping us make choices about what we're going to do to make your project. So you're still part of in that world, right? Mm-hmm. And I suppose this is the thing, when it goes up, say up the system, it may be that you're informing people who aren't quite in your world, but may indirectly or directly at some point in the future. So you've got this separation of time and space between when that story's been shared and how it might influence things. And that can change over time. And I suppose if you shorten and shorten and shorten the P&I cycle, like you're saying, for instance, do you effectively become, say, in a co-design space? Like, because people are sharing stories and, okay, we've come together and we're going to see what's going on in our community and we're going to see what's the situation around this. And we might share stories and those stories might go up, but we're also going to actually see if we can design this park. We're going to design a new type of way of laying some things in this park. So you're actually also part of being in an action field. It's more of a local community action field as opposed to like, this is your role. And I think this is one of the things that I'm coming across now. And I've actually mapped out a whole load of stuff around embodied cognition. And it's sort of helping me get some clarity around this is with between grounded cognition, which is actually more simulation based, which ties very much to stories. And then you've got other forms, which are much more kind of symbolic, you know, and abstract. Mm-hmm. And the way that rolls out is significant, I think, in terms of at the local level, you're in this kind of abductive space. You want people to be in a relatively abductive space and a reflective space in many cases. And what you also are seeing, and this is what I've actually found, is as you go up the system, you start to move into more future orientated perspectives, more strategically, and that becomes a slightly more abstracted space because now you can't just, and P&I in some ways tries to bridge that gap. It allows people to think about the future to also have an element of groundedness in their thinking. It's not just what's been mapped out on a diagram. Mm-hmm. But there is a sense of like, and it really depends on what type of intervention. I suppose it depends on what's been done. If this is an intervention with a community, which I know P&I really wants to have that as an important part of where it can be contributing, is it that there needs to be, are there kind of, I know what you call it, brothers and sisters that we should be hanging out with down there, right, alongside us. And is co-design work, which has grown a lot. And actually, the really interesting thing they talk about in co-design is, say you've got, this is normal, okay, so hey, so you've got a project and it's all crazy at the beginning. You can see my hands on, right? Sort of, see my squiggly finger. There's a diagram that basically says it's all squiggly up here. Mm-hmm. And someone decides what the brief is and what's going to happen. And then about this point, it gets given to the designer in traditional design. Mm-hmm. That's the brief. They do the brief. They deliver. It goes out into the thing, and then they finish. And then what happens thereafter is someone else's problem. And what's interesting with co-design is that how people come in, mm-hmm, and the probes, they talk about probes as well. Mm-hmm. The probes that look at what is that you're even going to work on and who's going to be working on it becomes part of the designer's consideration. And what happens thereafter becomes part of the designer's consideration. And someone called Saunders, this lady, Liz Saunders, has done a lot of work on that. And she's got something called the Convivial Toolbox, which is kind of a whole co-design. So I'm trying to see how, like, is it that this... Is it like if I'm going along like this with my engagement and I do some P&I, is like the co-design stays here, my P&I goes up, starts to engage at the organizational level, the co-design stays here, and then brings down strategic decision-making to support that with new resources from a higher level, and the co-design work stays at a more grounded level. And the P&I's strength is that ability to send things up the system.
Yes. Well, I think of it, here's another metaphor for you. If you think about packaging on food, like say I'm going to eat a tomato, right? Now I could have picked that tomato 10 seconds ago in my garden in the summer and eat it, right? So it's immediate, it's alive, right? Or I could have bought the tomato at my grocery store, but it was shipped from Brazil or something. Yeah. And it's gone through, you know, it's been on a container ship. It's been refrigerated for weeks. It's, you know, it was picked when it was green. All of this complicated stuff. And it might have all these different layers of packaging to it. you know, it's in a plastic bag, the bag's in a thing, it's in a box, whatever, I don't know. But, and that the same thing is true with stories. So like if you're, if it's totally local, right? If I'm saying my family and I say, well, she's doing it again, that's all I have to say. They know who I'm talking about, what that she's doing, what does it mean? There's a whole universe of meaning around that thing that is kind of part of the story, but I don't have to say it. And so, like, the local stories are very, there's, like, a lot of coding around them that you don't have to say. But if you talk about this this transmission of stories up into a hierarchy or across a big network of localities or whatever, then you have to add all this packaging, right? So, like, if you look at, like, a documentary film, you know, a story that's told, there's a whole lot that has to be inside the shell of the story because the context isn't shared. And so I think that one problem with stories is that a lot of people only see one side of that. Like they think a story is the thing that's in the documentary with all the stuff inside of it, and that's the only thing that's the story. And then other people see it as the only thing that's the story is the totally local thing where all you have to say is she's doing it. Whereas it's really the whole gamut, all stories, and that's... And that's all PNI too, because it can work at all of those levels, and it in stories that are going back and forth between them, that it changes how you do the project, but it can work at all those levels.
Maybe I have an example of something in the middle of that. We have a project in a city called Enschede, and it's close to the German border, and there. The social services department has something like 8 teams that each have a neighborhood. And they collect stories, how they do their work. And only one of these teams, if you look at the data from the stories, they say, something is changing. So there's a P&I cycle in all these 8 teams. And only one of them has a different pattern, and that has attracted, and that was what Stefan was talking about, the attention of the management that run their regular PDCA cycle, plan, check, do, act, while we always say sharing, inciting, decisioning, evolving. That's what we call P&I in some customers. Especially customers that are very hooked on PDCA, we introduce a side process. And that doesn't sound very dangerous until they see the results. And what's now happening is that they did an analysis of what's different between the teams or what's different parts of the city that these teams are attached to, and it turned out, or it seems to be, that the difference is in the team. That one team has all the young people in it, while the other teams have these grumpy 50-year-olds that have been in working in the social domain for 30 years, and this one team is 30-year-olds that came in from all kind of places, and they simply approach their work differently. So now, instead of a social target, it has become an HR problem. How can we rejuvenate the other 7 teams who spread this way of work through the organization? And the other problem, of course, is how are we changing the old ways of work of the people that are already in this field for 30 years without firing them? So then you get the next question. How many of these young people can you take out of this team and bring to another team or hire new people until it becomes infectious, that their way of working infects the other workers and say, okay, let's innovate. And so it's a second level story instead of the stories from the municipality and the stories from how we do their work. It has now become a story of change and an HR story. And so it goes up, like you say, Stefan, it's second, I'm not sure if it's second level learning or third loop learning or whatever, But suddenly it becomes learning and higher up in the organization, because something is still going on in the bottom. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, I think, I mean, is it, this diagram is almost two horizontal groups interacting, but they're feeding stuff. The control level is in a way taking stuff up to management. So you got, say you got eight groups, and then HR, you'd say HR is probably at a higher level in the system.
Well, HR is in the PDCA cycle. Maybe you didn't see it, but I shared an image on the chat.
Yeah, I see that.
And the top is the plan, do, check, act cycle.
Yeah.
And the lower thing is the, yeah, here it's called risk, but you can call it side, you can call it P&I, whatever. But what we always say is one goes clockwise and the other goes counterclockwise. And if they both do their run at the same, if the store, if the sense making in P&I runs at the same rate or the same as the PDCI cycle, nothing happens. But when they get out of sync, you get firework between the narrative domain and the planning domain. And it's just like what we call in physics a Van der Graaff generator. You get all these sparks. And it, you get sparks between the planning cycle and the P&I and the narrative reality. And that ends up either in the newspaper or in stress or in people leaving the organization or whatever. And yeah. And that's an image that a lot of decision makers really like, that they need to keep the narrative cycle in sync with the planning cycle, or else they will have...
Can I ask you one thing? Is the point of interception the C, the control? The point is, it just happens that the two C's are next to each other. Is that where the two cycles kind of interact, or it just happens to be that those two C's are next? Or can they all, is it that the cycles somehow clash, or is it when you reach the C, control point, that's when you notice the clash? Or is it that planning can clash with insight?
Yeah, it's check. In the PDCI cycle, it is the check thing. Is reality really what we thought it was? And on the P&I cycle, it is the decision-making the interventions. And if the interventions don't match up with the check on PDCA, you get firework, because then you get a fight between the practitioners from the lower part of the organization, on the planners and the finance people in the top of the organization. And in a lot of organizations, the planners win and the practitioners lose.
do you try to engineer that engineer is probably not the word I'm looking for, but try to initiate that missed cycle so that you will get that clash? As you said, if they both run and they run in, obviously they run in little circles and nothing gets done. So how do you engineer, or how do you to push?
Well, we take the Cynthia approach. Keep it small. Don't oversell it. Explain every day that you cannot prove anything with P&I until the people are so fed up that they go to the management and say this should change. So we try to keep in the background and not interfere that much. So do we engineer? Yes, we downscale. We say, if you really believe and this is your decision, go and party, but it's not us telling you to do. We're not the consultants. We're the facilitators of the process, because that's the still the people in the PDCA cycle pay us. So if we get the blame, we also don't get the next phase of the project.
You guys get paid for this stuff? I didn't realize that.
Well, you know, if you think about two gears turning together, they turn in opposite directions.
Two ears.
Gears.
They gears, yeah.
Directions, but they are in contact at all times, and they are coordinated. And they the friction that is between them is what makes the whole thing work, right?
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's a good visual. Now, yeah, and I'm just reimagining the simple plan as a geared thing. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, but the problem, of course, is if the balls don't have the same speed, then it's, of course, it's the friction that makes things run. But if the things start sliding, and especially when it's non-conducting surfaces, you get a lot of static energy, and that's where the fireworks start. And that's what's called a Van der Graaff generator.
Yes, but gears don't have to be the same size.
Sorry?
Gears don't have to be the same size.
No, that's correct. The upper one can run faster than the lower one, because the planning cycle is usually once a year, and the P&I cycles are something like 5-6 times a year.
So in fact, there can be the P&I gear can be small enough so that it repeats within each one of the bigger cycles.
Oh yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So reality is always more weird than planning.
Right. there can be reality within planning, reality within decision making, reality within checking, and whatever the other ones were.
the other part, of course, is that the planning reality can change. If the government decides that there's new budgeting halfway the year and the municipality get less money, yeah, well, the best thing they can do is turn to the practitioners and say, tell us some stories how to solve this problem. How can we cut budget without harming your work? And because of all this narrative material, I think they will be able to answer that question. And in this case, the question will be in that one team. So I think this is an example of where one team was learning something that's now propagating to the organization, both left and right and up and down.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, actually, one thing that's interesting with this is in the infusion framework, the infusion space, the top of the infusion space goes round clockwise. Bottom, it goes anti-clockwise. It's similar.
Yeah, same here.
It's the same type of thing. It's moving around, and where I have the piece where I have, so I don't know if you see, but I've been remapping it in terms of object-orientated space, because there's two pathways in the brain I found out during my research, okay, which is really, really cool. And there was, and it links into the Nobel Prize in 2014 was given to some people who found these things in place cells and grid cells. Okay. So what you've got is you've got two ways that I can make sense of things. I've got environmentally embodied is with picking up. So I've got this idea of I've got the computer. I've got this diagram. I've got these pair of glasses. These are things that I can see affordances. This diagram's given me affordances. And there's a sense of me enacting and doing stuff in relation to that. But what's also happening between us, and it requires that co-intersubjectivity, is we're creating something between us. As I'm acting, there's a certain sense of understanding between Cynthia and me and Helen, which is not the same as the object approach to affordance. It's more subjective. And this is kind of that. So the intersubjectivity is where art sits, because art opens up how I relate to something. Whereas an object is a thing. It's about what it is, not where I relate to it. So if you take, I would still call these, I would still put these two, when these things play out in one person, so when these play out in me, yes, this is vertical thing works. The planning, if you take the viable system model, and I was actually, the viable system model, it talks about the kind of, you've got the kind of planning levels here, and you've got that kind of the generative, like what's the bottom line parts of the system which are interacting with the environment. What I think is happening is So actually this embodies quite nicely the way you put the thing on the top and the bottom. But when you go into an organization, okay, you can see yourselves having a kind of a supra, they call it a supra person, supra personal perspective or an intersubjective. So imagine you have a supersized sense of groundedness, action, and cognition, and you're somehow relating within that. So the planning department is relating within that from an action to cognition perspective. They're very and about doing things in the future with objects. The narrative world, or especially the world where people are actually working to relate to people, so a therapist, a performer, a consultant in many ways, the consultancy aspect, which is about a salesperson, which is about how to engage, or an activist, they're working very much with the intersubjective piece between people. It's about elicit inaction in people, not just by doing stuff with things. And the narrative, I think, naturally, I mean, P&I is not, unlike most ties, they're very separate normally, like arts and science, very separate. But because you're using narrative not purely in a art sense, and you're not making decision-making purely in a linear sense, the two things mesh. And if they mesh, and that is, you know, on the right-hand side of that infusion space, I've got that kind of like disruption, like a gray area of disruption. That's where the two things, they're spinning in different directions. If they're overlapped, that's where you get the clash. Mm-hmm. And if they're harmonized and surprises, they become more like a ritual. Yeah. So it's more like a ritual on one side and disruption on another side. Mm-hmm. So I think if you then take this diagram into the meso level, you need to flip this onto the flat plane, and this fits in the parts of that infusion space. Not exactly, because it's, you know, obviously it wasn't designed, but the general kind of idea does. And that is that's kind of a change now, because when you, and this comes back to the silos, because as a person I can tell a narrative, I can plan, I can do something. But if I go into the account and I align myself, oops, have I lost? Hello? If I go to the accounts department, I become part of a planning cycle, right? I'm now in the meso level in a silo, and I move around to the silo, which is all around working on, say I work in a creative department, I'm an illustrator who creates crazy wacky diagrams, but I still need to feed, I'm still working for a company that's got an accounts department, you know. Or so what we've done is we've effectively become horizontal, but and this is where it gets hard, because the dimensions, the spatial cognition, the dimensions move. One dimension that can move particularly, and there's a whole load of research, is the dimension of time, and how you orientate to time can be redone. It's actually like, if you go out to, there's evidence of stuff of tribes in the Andes, and they actually orientate time to the river flowing down the hill. So time is not, some things are very, like power nearly always goes up, and that's fairly consistent. But some other, and that also would relate to our bodies and how we are in the world and what we learn as a child. But one thing that does flip a bit is how you relate to time, and if you're orientated to that, and then you've got a level above where I've been looking at this idea of, you know, I won't go any further, but if you go one idea above and you go back up to, say, policy level, you hear that people talk about a body of knowledge. You know, you hear, so for instance, I'm working for the legislature, and you actually find people now, and they're not even in the field of practice, they're working in the House of Commons, making the arm of the law, using the arm of the law to create a legislature which then rolls out to all these different fields of practice, be it IBM. So, you know, you've got the management of IBM, and then you've got the legislation that covers the field of technology. Well, nobody actually does that. They create a body and they service that body. So it's a third person, literally. And then that becomes, so that this is what I'm trying to put together, but it makes a lot of sense, because I think this is where one of the challenges is, the way that things get re-embodied in space as we move up. And P&I is trying to do that. It's trying to go up, but you can't. I think one of the things that P&I does, because when you use a story, it doesn't when you make an opinion, you basically compress things down to one physical set of orientations. And I think a lot of it is tacit, which means it's embodied in terms of how you assume things in space. Anyway, so that's something that's just come up, and it's tying in a lot with the some new ideas in neuroscience, because they've got this whole idea of something called the place cells, and they actually say that you actually fire up your place cells, fire up when you're in a place and when you're relative to stuff. So there's a good chance that route of using place cells and building up your knowledge through the sense of place is a different pathway to the sense of how you relate to objects.
Good. I was looking, you know, sort of searching as you were talking. So this is O'Keefe Moser and place cells and grid cells.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
And it's really, really, really impactful, because there's a dorsal pathway and another pathway, which, and what they're basically thinking is that these grid cells and place cells, and that may well be how we build our knowledge. We just have, because there's like a million arrangements of different ways that these place cells and grid cells work. And the grid cells are always hexagonal. They're a grid of hexagons, which is quite interesting. But anyway, that becomes a bit esoteric. But the key thing...
The Guardian refers to it as an inner GPS in the brain, which I thought was an interesting comment.
Yeah. I think it links very closely to story, because I think story, and especially when stories is embodied, I think we'll go into that mode, if that makes sense. Whereas I think that when things are very abstract, they go into the thing mode. Sorry, go on.
I've got too many thoughts backed up in my mind here. Well, one thing about that place cell thing is I read something ages ago that just was really interesting, and it was where they were doing experiments with place cells, and I think it was mice or rats, and they had them running in a maze, and then they could basically watch them later on, and they were replaying the stories of all the places they've been in the maze, because you can see it going around in the neurons and everything. And so they were basically watching them tell themselves stories, which I thought was fascinating, because it's just showing that's what we do, you know, and then probably we're not the only species who tells the stories. Now, whether they tell stories to each other is an open question, but at least recounting experiences is something that's very widespread. And that was something else I was going to say about what you just said, but I forget now. I can't remember it now.
No, I just, this is all new to me. I missed on this, but I'm just reading the Guardian, you know, article, basically just a news article on the wind, what it's about. Yeah. Great. I'm do some more looking at this later.
Okay, yeah. I remembered it. Oh, were you done?
I mean, the implication, I mean, the main thing I think that's really interesting is I think that we often move towards the more object orientated in our workplace.
Oh yeah, I know what I was gonna. I remember what my reaction was to something you were saying. It was about opinions.
Yes.
And the difference between opinions and stories, and an opinion is really devoid of any contextual information. If you say, what do you think people should be doing about this? And people say, well, I think it should be this way. There is no context in that whatsoever. You can't, it's almost like it's stripped bare of everything, right? And you can't get it back because it's just not there. It's like an opinion is like a measurement of the distance from someone's, you know, pinky to their thumb. It's not much use, right? It doesn't tell you much about the person. But if you ask a person a story to tell you an experience they've had, and then you ask your opinion as a way that emerges from the story, you've then got all this context around it. And the way I always think of it visually is that a story is like a seed. And one of the most important things in the seed is that I think it's called the endosperm, which is the food for the seed. I think it's the right word. Anyway, the endosomes. It's the food. Most of the seed is food for the developing embryo that is inside. And that's the contextual parts of the story, the explanations of what's going on in the world of the person who's telling you the story. And that's the thing, that if you're very local, there's very little endosperm because the seed doesn't need a lot of food because it's right local. It doesn't need to travel, right? And so there's this very thin seed coat. But if the story is something somebody knows is going to be, or if you're doing an interview or something, like lately I've been doing these interviews for a project, and if they surprise me by one of their questions, I'll just stop everything and say, why'd you say that? And then it gets added on to the story. So I want to understand, I want to build up that seed coat, that, oh, that's going to drive me crazy. I've got to look that up.
Well, we're having that question with our evaluation because, I mean, in some ways, I know what you were saying. It's interesting because exactly the same thing you said, and we're probably always almost the type of people that would be saying and saying what you say. There's not much you can do with an opinion. You'd have the other side where someone that they can do very quickly and synthesize, and they say, well, there's not much you can do with a story. And it's because it all depends. If you're coming from if you're coming from the perspective of cognition, which is about defining what something is, what kind of something is, as opposed to where it is. See, the thing that is important, and this is where it makes sense with place cells, is a story useful if you're looking for the relationship to where it's from. An opinion, if you don't need that,
yeah,
then suddenly opinions become, and often if you're just trying to build a bridge, and you know, there's a big push to things which are universal, and of course, universality. So I think you make what's interesting here is that, I mean, I'm seeing a synergy between. I see this sometimes. Your diagram here is like kind of stripped down much more, Harold. But it's really interesting. I think that some of the thinkings are kind of aligning. But what I'm really interested in, and I've been working with this, is once you start playing with embodied cognition and spatial cognition and start saying, okay, how do things get re-embodied at these different levels?
That's another layer of endosperm, and it is endosperm. The spatial thing, that's another layer, because if you bring that out and you get people to talk about that and you evoke it, that's yet another layer. That's more food for the embryo, you know?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And
Hi, Mark.
So one of the problems you get with language, just language, let me forget about story or opinion, the challenge you have with language, and you can negate it to some extent with metaphor and all these other things, is you're still compressing down the experience to this kind of sequential form and compressing it. And you use metaphors and that to get around that. And that's where I'm really think that what happens with tacit knowledge, and this is where the challenge comes with going between things, is when I say stuff, say we start saying stuff now about P&I, right? Subconsciously, I'm unpacking it and unpacking it in a very similar, probably some similar broad spatial embodied ways that we all are, because we've managed to align ourselves over time, right? Now, once you go to another silo, the problem can be that those, and so when someone sees a word differently, it may actually be they see the word embodied differently. They're unpacking it. And that is a very different, that's a very difficult thing to overcome. It's like, that becomes this slow learning, because you've almost got to go in and so I'm actually really interested in how can story work also be worked into three-dimensional landscape work? Because I think there's times where you want to actually also have, how is this unpacking? And maybe to try and embed it all within dimensions of metadata, you know, maybe if there was also some experiential mid, that's what I'm thinking these topographies can be. And also obviously the story would give the topography a meaning, because without it's just a room, you know, but and it needs to travel. But I'm kind of excited, but I mean, Howard, did it make sense when I talked about in one person your diagram could be vertical, and then once you move into a siloed set of fields of practice at organizational level, it would start to become part of a horizontal set of churns? Or is that?
Yeah, I think even if you have a community that uses PNI, say for that site stuff, there is also a planning circle, like the agricultural planning circle. Did we plow the ground in? It's almost following the seasons. The planning circle of a community, an agricultural community, is following the season. I mean, it's dictated by spring, summer, autumn, winter, and they're checking, do we have enough food for the winter? And then they have a good conversation with the village. How are we going to survive, given the fact that we don't have enough food? Are we going to rob the neighbors or not? I mean, so I think PDCA planning and story work is always part of a self-organized community anyway, because PDCA is not a bad thing. It's part of the ordered part of the community. And the story thing, yeah, I would almost say intermingles with that. They're interdependent. So,
but if you're thinking about, say, the situation where someone's trying to worry about getting food and raiding someone else, I mean, I would almost say that in that context, people have got into a kind of an organizational mode. I mean, I know it's happening.
Yeah.
Once people are in the point of like, I've got my silo of food here, effectively that becomes like an organizational part of their life.
Yeah.
It's happening in the local farm, as opposed to say, what we're going to do at the local dance. That makes sense. Or what I'm going to do at, you know, I think that even if you go to like an indigenous community, it's just that they don't have that space that you get in the modern world. Like the chief in the community, whereas once you get to the municipality and the district and the, you know, they can't. It's just not possible. So,
well, I've got a sort of half family there at Manitoulin Island. And what she told me, she said, okay, there were these evenings 50 years ago where the elders of the village invited a couple of people to talk about some young people that had to learn a couple of things because they were going off the path. It had nothing to do with food and planning, but it was more in the social domain that they wanted to teach these youngsters a couple of lessons of how to be a good First Nation. Or an Indian at the time. I mean, so, and that was in the story domain. It was in the social domain. Yeah. And the other thing is, do we have enough food? Is in the planning domain, in the economic domain. So I think, of course, if there's a fire in the storeroom where all the food is stored for winter, you wouldn't have a conversation the next Wednesday in the tipi on three youngsters going rogue in their life. The question would be, how can we resupply food stock for the winter? I mean, that's an emergency thing. So the economic domain, the social domain, the human domain, the health domain, they all mingle. And when things run right in a silo, why should you discuss it? I mean, does it need management attention? I don't think so.
I wonder, I have a thing that I would like to talk about that's related to learning and stories, but I don't know if you guys are ready for it, or did you want to finish what you were talking about?
Just made one response to Harold, and then just the only point is, you notice how you talked about going to the teepee? Okay.
Yeah.
That's a particular space. And within that space, time and place, time and the relationship spatially in how we configure things cognitively has a particular construct, which is not the same as when we're not in the teepee. So even though, and I think that same principle is actually carrying on in our modern world. It's just that we've got so many layers to it and levels to it that it's not so clear.
I think that things can be discussed in the tippy in a way that can't be discussed outside the tippy, and the other way around. So what I'm just saying is that the subject being discussed in the tippy on Wednesday, because it was always a Wednesday, might depend on what's happening outside. And if there's an emergency that needs to be discussed, that interrupts the planned subject of the week, because that can wait for another week, but the food shortage can't wait.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. And that, and in South Africa, they have the Ngozi, which is the mini chief, and then they've got the big chief. And the mini chief is the one that meets around the tree, and they get the berries and make the Zulu beer for the Amarula festival. And then it goes to the big chief, who tests it. But there is that sense of like the teeth, there's a sense of like scale does change things. You know what I mean? Like that, like, so for instance, say you're talking about, and the First Nations, they do have a way of dealing with that. They have ways of making teepees so that you can come together. But I suppose at some point it gets stretched out where you've got so many layers between, and so much scaling between different types of what you could, like you could call Parliament a teepee effectively.
Just,
but the way it's been conceptualized is different. But actually, if you start to go in and look at all the languaging around how it's embodied, like the House of Commons, well, you don't have a house at work, but you have a house back at home. You know, but once you get into, so it's back to a place, it's very place-based, it's very tied to history, just like the home. But work, the middle zone, tends to be very thing orientated, very dead in some ways.
Well, actually, that's kind of.
But I will stop there because I know Cynthia's got something to say.
Well, what I wanted to, you know, usually before we have these calls, I poke around a little bit on the internet to see if I can find something to talk about. And the thing I noticed today in the 3 minutes I looked at this before we started talking, was I was typing in learning and stories, and I noticed a very interesting thing in the things that I saw that had to do with adults. Pretty much everything was related to motivation and attention. So it was stories motivate people to pay attention. Stories get people's attention. Stories are memorable. They keep coming. People coming back. That sort of thing. Then there was another whole body of things having to do with children. And when you looked at stories with children, it talked about imagination, curiosity, making sense of things, cognitive development, coping with feelings, developing strategies for dealing with their life. And I was like, wow, all those things apply to adults. But nobody talks about that. When you look at learning and stories together, and adults are the subject, it's almost like you can't say any of those things. And I think that's a really curious pattern. It's like, why are we not allowed to do any of those things as adults? It has to be all just jollying people along or something. I don't know. It's a very curious pattern. I wonder what anybody thinks about it.
Well, the difference is the education system. There you unlearn to do all these things. the military training system called a school.
Well, it is mostly for young children, actually, that this is all talked about. There's very little when children get over, say, 12, that they're talking about that.
Yeah, okay, so it starts at 6. The unstorifying starts at 6. It's finished at 12, so you can go into the education army. Yeah.
I think it's that idea of knowing. There's this sense of, if I know something, it becomes a thing that I can define. I mean, I remember that being in my physics class. They always used to say, I'm going to teach you this now, but when you get to university, you're going to find out that's not really the case. There's that kind of thing. You know, it's a bit like, and in some ways, it kind of makes sense, right? Because you kind of need to give someone something which is digestible. But you do give this false sense of knowing. Because things, you know, well, just by calling something a story, which makes sense, but we've called it a, I mean, it's not such a solid object.
That's one thing, making things a thing, that ruins story also. But I think that you see story coming back, but it's not called story. It's called serious gaming. It's called... I just visited a company last week. They want to cooperate with us because they make games for companies. I mentioned your Neurotopia. And you know what the first thing they said, Cynthia? We should make car decks. Car decks for healthcare. Car decks for...
Well, I wanted to do that, yeah.
Yeah, and they, for instance, have a game for... asset management, and they have a game for crisis management in electricity companies, and they've created something like 25 games and game boards that they use to train people over and over again as part of the game of being aware of safety problems. And they have physical boxes. It's not a digital game. It's a physical with I would say that packs and cards, and it's very interesting.
I have found myself in probably in the last 6 months, starting to read you know, items I find on the net, etc., about games and gamification, and I'm finding it quite fascinating. I used to sort of put games down because I considered it an escape, and not reality, I guess, is the way. And I had a couple of friends who were quite serious gamers, and they didn't seem to be too connected with things on a day-to-day basis. And that's probably where my prejudice was nurtured. The deeper I've got into story, especially in the last year, games just keep popping up here, there, and everywhere. And the concepts of gamification and I mean, it's interesting. Let's put it that way. And I'm
They were a bit surprised when I suggested they had cards, Cynthia, that were this big. Yeah. And they were little cartoons that said something. Okay, the new cables are delivered, so we can now start planning the work. And then the next cartoon was, okay, we made a schedule for whatever. And to lay down this cable in the street. This was Tenet, the electricity company. And so they had 5 or 6 images. And I said, and what would happen if you placed, can you tell me a story about something that happened when the goods were delivered? And they were looking at me and said, that's where the bridge to P&I is. It's asking a question. Because they were more using this as a way to plan or to have a game together about planning problems. And they were actually asking people to point in these images and tell people why they pointed there. And I was pointing at a little boy looking at the last image. And saying this is dangerous because if he climbs over, he will fall into the into the ditch that they just made. And they said the reason that picture is there is because the boy says, maybe I want to do this later when I'm grown up. So they were looking more at the HR side of things to interest people. And I was more looking at the danger side of things. What will happen if this guy gets so interested that he wants to start right away? And then they started saying, aha, so if we have this, what do you see in this image question, and share the story, something that happened recently or longer ago, that this, it becomes an elicitation question. So the gap between a play somebody developed and turning it to something P&I-ish isn't very, is much easier from a game that people already play than it is from a business process where you want to attach something storified. Because when people are playing, stories are just around the corner, and it's like, what you always say, Cynthia, that stories are a way to communicate things that you wouldn't say face to face. I think in a game, it's exactly the same thing. You can propose an event or choose an event card that everybody thinks, this is nonsense. But when you choose it, you actually influence the story of the game. Mm-hmm. And people will hate you for choosing it. But it's just a game.
Well, I think
so gaming.
Sharing stories with each other is a game. It's an
ancient. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yep. Rules were written 10,000 years ago or something. And you can see people start to play the game. You know, if you see people in a group and they start doing it, you can just see them click in. You know, it's like, okay, yeah, those are the rules now. And but the thing that frustrates me is that the things that people say that stories do for children, I've seen all those things happen with adults. Mm. And I would like to start talking more about all those things happening with adults and how it has the potential to do all that for us, and not just talk about how you can use stories to get people to do what you want, you know?
Okay, you're more interested in the story work part than in the storytelling part.
Yeah, but even when you talk about story work, it's still people don't get it. They cut off the benefits of stories at the age of 10 or something and say, well, that's no longer available. But it's always available. It's available your whole life. And I don't know why people are blind to that. It's like what you said. We just don't see it anymore. But
well, when you choose that card and then you choose another card, every time you choose a card, you move into an area of uncertainty. So you revise your story if you're a winner, to use a phrase, and that is, has to be a winner loser, but you revise the story to the elements that card presents, the possibilities it presents, and that's an ongoing process. You just keep revising from card to card, and you create a narrative that hopefully goes in the direction you want it to. Anyway, maybe you create a narrative that doesn't go in that direction, and you understand whatever the content is much better.
Well, I think that if we would approach reintroducing story from asking the questions, what games do people play? What rituals do people have? And then try to attach story from that instead of going from the hard-nosed business side of things or where are stories just around the corner, mm-hmm, would be a much better approach to reintroducing story than how can we attach story to something hard. So if you've got people in playful mode or ritual mode or whatever, reflective mode or festive mode or sporting mode or whatever,
So I think ritual is the best word, because there is no process involving human beings that is devoid of ritual. There's ritual mm-hmm. in everything. No matter how hard people think a thing is, no matter how structured it is, there's always ritual. It's like the planning, you know? And so that's, yeah, that makes sense to kind of bring the stories in there.
Well, getting awake is a ritual. It's totally different for Cynthia than for Harold, but it is a ritual.
When two rituals clash is when you're getting... I mean, in some ways, there's ritual which is more of an intentional ritual. Like, you can say everything's everything to some extent, but there's moments when... and if I take... When surprise reduction is a focus, ritual happens. Okay? When you're embracing a surprise reduction modality, when you're trying to disrupt surprise and make things, it becomes a much more, not so much, it can be ritual in the way you do it, but you're trying to mm-hmm. churn things up. Oh God, what is it? The thing that I was just thinking about there, on the bit, I've lost it.
You were saying about personal rituals.
Yeah, and just before the rituals, we were talking about the, what was just before rituals? Games.
Yeah.
One of the things with games is that I think the reason games come in, I think the board games is one step removed, but it's still a little bit thing orientated, a bit opinion, because they do a lot of game stuff at Design with Dialogue. Like, they have a lady game, well, I actually know it's called Dinosaur or Die, or something like that, or Innovate or Dinosaur. So it's like a whole thing about getting to innovate. But it tends to be, and this is where it's interesting, is it tends to be when you're in the board game, it's opinion to opinion. It's kind of, and it is kind of related to awareness, but the where is slightly abstracted conceptual board game where in terms of the place. And when you take the story, you're taking a story which is where. And like, so in some ways, the board game becomes the body, if that makes sense, because it's kind of like, you know, it's, you know, like Monopoly, you know, suddenly you start to align with the circle of the board and you go around the board and that becomes the world that embodies how things move. Whereas the type of story you're talking about, and there's a, you know, you can say there's a story of the game and that is, but the story of the game really is me embodying myself as I do the game. You know, which is actually a fully embodied moment. And the stories that you're talking about, Harold, that people elicit is slightly different to what they do when they're doing the board games. But I think it is an easier way in because people are much more comfortable with what. And actually, one of the things I did find when I did my social topography thing, a design with dialogue, and I got people to map out their workplace with the fabrics and stuff. And what I found is that some of them, particularly the ones who work more on the future work and the strategy work, wouldn't show social topography. They didn't want to reveal a workplace context. They were much safer and felt much more confident because they didn't know who else was in the room and it wasn't necessarily a safe space. So they could talk about, here's my computer and here's my this and this is how I relate to my different, you know, software design thing, but they wouldn't want to say like, here's my boss and here's my, you know, and this is, and I think the two different pathways I mentioned are quite at play here. I think the what pathway compared to the where pathway and the stuff around it, and the what pathway is a slightly more abstracted instrumental pathway. It's complex, right? But the general patterns seem to be consistent.
Well, I think the what and the where versus, it's kind of like a rock versus a seed, you know? A rock, you can carry it around and it won't change, right? And you don't have to keep it alive and you can pitch it and nothing bad is going to happen to it. But a seed is different. It can die and you have to treat it differently and it contains things in it that you have a purpose other than to take it somewhere else. Whereas the what element of it, you can just carry it around and, you know, throw it around. It won't hurt anything.
Especially
even if it's
a little bit.
What's that?
It's actually germinated. That's also where the seed is much more vulnerable to that. Once it's still a thing in a packet, but once you've germinated it, now you've got that context thing is suddenly much more
Well, that's why I like the metaphor of stories as seeds, because it's a thing. It's both. It's a thing and a living thing, right? It's alive. A seed is alive as long as it's alive, but it's also an object. So it's a process and an object at the same time, and that's what I think is a good metaphor of it bridging the worlds. And you can have a seed that is sitting under the soil for thousands of years, but it's still alive, maybe, and it can grow again. And, you know, that's really fascinating.
And now we get all these alarming stories about global warming and old viruses escaping from on the glaciers and killing the world population. And that's why people don't like story. They're like viruses. And you're bringing it back alive, Cynthia. It's your fault.
Yeah. Well, sometimes it's not good to bring it back alive, at least not clumsily, you know?
I was just joking.
But... And now it's the death of insects. That's the latest. Yeah.
Yeah, I tend to say that also. We don't have a climate problem. We've got an environmental problem. That's a much bigger problem than the climate. Okay, that's where we went astray in the last. We started talking about climate.
We got into climate, and I think it was 20 minutes later.
That's Jerry that caused the problem again.
Okay, thanks, everybody.